circle around the school grounds. Decades later, people would sometimes see a gray-haired woman peddling still. By 1940, Quirrell had reached a kind of melancholy peace with Carol's fate. "All sense of flesh, of my flesh, is gone," she wrote in her journal. "I feel toward her as tenderly as ever, but I am no longer torn. I am, I suppose, what may be called resigned at last. Agony has become static. It is true, but I will not disturb it or allow it to move in me." Pearl continued publishing at an industrial pace, but her literary reputation had grown dim. The men who came to dominate American mid-century literature treated her writing merely as women's novels. Pearl tried to write about life in the United States, but readers thought of her only as a chronicler of China. She also made a growing number of enemies with her political activity. Even at the height of World War II, she criticized the American government, asking how the United States could fashion itself as the enemy of fascism when it accepted white superiority at home and promoted imperialism abroad. After the war, the FBI decided she was a communist in spirit, if not in party membership. Pearl could sense that hostility was growing around her, but she didn't stop working for her causes. She even took up new ones. Having adopted 5 children, she spoke out against orphanages and foster homes. Before she knew it, a desperate mother had dropped off a child at her farm. Pearl responded by creating a private adoption agency specializing in finding homes for Amerasian children who were rejected by both sides of their family. Pearl raised money for the research in Vineland, and by the 1940s she was in charge of fundraising for the entire school. One of the fundraisers she worked with urged her to publish something about Carol, to help draw attention to the school. At first, Pearl found the requests intensely annoying, but eventually the fundraiser won her over. She sat down and began to write about Carol. "I have been a long time making up my mind to write this story," she began. Pearl presented a clear-eyed account of Carol's childhood and her own pain, shame, and reconciliation. She confessed to thinking how her daughter might be better off dead. She recounted how she learned to stop blaming Carol for what was not her fault and to recognize her right to develop her mind as far as nature would allow. "It was my child who taught me to understand so clearly all people are equal in their humanity and that all have the same human rights," Pearl wrote. "Though the mind is gone away, though he cannot speak or communicate with anyone, the human stuff is there, and he belongs to the human family." Pearl published her essay in Ladies' Home Journal in May 1950, and it was later released as a short book called The Child Who Never Grew. All the royalties went to the Vineland Training School. In 1950, when intellectual developmental disability was still a source of shame and confusion, her frankness was nothing short of astonishing, especially coming from a best-selling Nobel Prize-winning writer. The Child Who Never Grew was translated into 13 languages, and Pearl got mailbags full of letters from parents of children like Carol. She answered every one. At the end of the book, Pearl called for better care for people like Carol and urged that more research go into understanding intellectual developmental disorders, pointing to the work carried out at Vineland as an example of what needed to be done. She highlighted Goddard's intelligence testing and the Vineland social maturity scale. It's telling that Pearl didn't mention the research that first brought the Vineland Training School to international attention, Goddard's study of heredity. In fact, Pearl took great pains to scrub Carol's story clean of any possible hereditary taint. She declared that there was no trace of mental retardation in her own family or in Lossing's. Carol's story, in other words, had nothing to do with the other famous tale of a Vineland student, the Kallikak family. "The old stigma of something in the family is all too often unjust," Pearl wrote. Unbeknownst to Pearl, there was something in the family after all. It was not an inheritance of sin or degeneration, however. It was a hereditary disease. In fact, a doctor had come to Vineland a decade before Pearl published The Child Who Never Grew and correctly diagnosed Carol with a disorder. No one had told Pearl, and she would have to wait another decade to find out for herself. 8 years after Pearl Buck gave birth to Carol, a woman in Oslo named Borgny Egeland had a girl of her own. Liv Egeland seemed a healthy baby at first, although Borgny was puzzled by the odor of her hair, skin, and urine. It reminded her of a horse stable. Her puzzlement turned to worry as Leave reached age 3, unable to utter a single word. Yet her doctor, finding nothing wrong with Leave, told Borgany to give her more time. Unlike Pearl Buck, Borgany Egeland was able to bear another child. In 1930, she gave birth to a son, Dag, who gave off the same musty odor as Leave. And later, he also failed to learn how to speak. Borgany searched for a doctor who could explain this bizarre coincidence. By the time Leave was 6, she could say only a few words and had trouble walking. Dag, now 4, couldn't talk at all. He was unable to eat, drink, or walk on his own. The doctors Borgany consulted had no explanation for why both of her children had developed the same symptoms, nor could they offer any treatment. Borgany refused to share their resignation. She kept visiting doctors until she ran out of names, and then she paid a woman to give her children baths in herb-soaked water. She sought help from a psychic. Finally, Borgany learned that her sister was acquainted with a doctor at Oslo University Hospital who was an expert on metabolic disorders. She asked her sister to contact the doctor, named Asbjørn Furling, to see if he thought their odor and their intellectual development were linked. Furling had never heard of such a thing. He doubted he could help, but he didn't want to disappoint Borgany after she had suffered so much. He invited her to bring the children to see him. The exam revealed nothing new, but Furling also asked Borgany to bring him some of Leave's urine so that he could carry out some chemical tests to track down the source of the odor. Furling carried out his experiments in a makeshift lab in the attic of the medical ward. He added drops of ferric chloride to Leave's urine to test for diabetes. If Leave had the disease, it would turn purple. Instead, her urine turned green. Furling had never seen such a thing. He hadn't even heard of such a thing happening before. Baffled, Furling asked Borgany to bring him some of Dag's urine. When Furling ran the test again, the urine shimmered green once more. Furling searched through the medical literature for an explanation, but no one had ever observed the reaction. He wondered if Borgany was giving her children aspirin or some other medicine that was tinting the urine. As a test, he asked Borgany to keep her children off any medication for a week. When he experimented on their urine again, it still turned green. It took 2 months of experiments and 22 liters of Egeland urine for Furling to finally find the cause. The children's urine was loaded with a compound not found in healthy people, a cluster of carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen atoms known as phenylpyruvic acid. Based on his deep knowledge of human metabolism, Furling came up with a hypothesis to explain the strange chemistry. Proteins are made of building blocks called amino acids. One amino acid is called phenylalanine, which people must get from their food. Any extra phenylalanine people don't use to make proteins gets broken down by enzymes in the liver. Furling reasons that the Egeland children were not breaking down their phenylalanine. Somehow, the rising level of phenylalanine harmed the children. Some of it was converted into a similar molecule, phenylpyruvic acid, and washed out of their bodies in their urine. To test his data, Furling examined other children with similar symptoms. He ended up finding the green signature in the urine of 10 patients in total. They included 3 pairs of siblings, a coincidence that led Furling to suspect the condition was a hereditary disorder. Yet Furling could plainly see that Borgany Egeland and all the other parents of these children were healthy. Some of them had other children who were healthy as well. The disorder must be caused by a recessive factor, Furling reasoned. Each parent was a carrier, with one defective copy of some unknown gene, and some of their children had the misfortune of inheriting a bad copy from both of them. Furling found support for this hypothesis when he followed up with 2 parents, each of whom had gotten remarried. Between them, they had 12 more children. All of their offspring from their new marriages were healthy, and none of them had urine that turned green. The recessive factor was probably very rare in Norway, Furling reasoned, meaning that the odds of marrying 2 people who were carriers was next to 0. The children of the second marriages might inherit 1 recessive factor at most, meaning that they could not develop the disease. Furling quickly wrote up his discovery and gave the disease a name, Imbecilitas phenylpyruvica. Not since Archibald Garrod had discovered that the black urine of alkaptonuria was a hereditary disorder had someone found such a clear-cut case. Yet few scientists paid Furling's 1934 paper much notice. He could not say precisely what was wrong in people with the disease, nor could he account for how a problem with phenylalanine could affect the brain. Only a small circle of scientists who studied intellectual developmental disorders recognized how important his findings were. Even if imbecilitas phenylpyruvica was rare, it still represented what Henry Goddard had been chasing after, a hereditary cause of feeble-mindedness. Froehlich's study was even more significant because he had invented a straightforward way to give a precise diagnosis. One of the first doctors to take up Froehlich's test was a British doctor named Lionel Penrose. Although only in his mid-30s at the time, Penrose had already become a leading expert on intellectual developmental disability in Britain. He had climbed the ranks swiftly, having come late to medicine. Penrose had started out studying mathematical logic at Cambridge, and then he traveled to Vienna to investigate the psychology of mathematical thinking. When that work hit a dead end, Penrose got curious about mental disorders and what they might reveal about the mind. At age 27, he returned to Cambridge to study medicine. 4 years later, now a freshly minted MD, Penrose became a medical research officer at the Royal Eastern Counties Institution at Colchester, a home for mental defectives. Penrose entered the profession as a passionate critic of eugenics, dismissing it as pretentious and absurd. In the early 1930s, eugenics still had a powerful hold on both doctors and the public at large, a situation Penrose blamed on lurid tales like the Kallikak family. While those stories might be seductive, eugenicists made a mess of traits like intelligence. They were obsessed with splitting people into two categories, healthy and feeble-minded, and then they would cast the feeble-minded as a class of vast and dangerous dimensions. Penrose saw intelligence as a far more complex trait. He likened intelligence to height. In every population, most people were close to average height, but some people were taller and shorter than average. Just being short wasn't equivalent to having some kind of a height disease. Likewise, people developed a range of different mental aptitudes. Height, Penrose observed, was the product of both inherited genes and upbringing. He believed the same was true for intelligence. Just as Mendelian variants could cause dwarfism, others might cause severe intellectual developmental disorders. But that was no reason to leap immediately to heredity as an explanation. That mental deficiency may be to some extent due to criminal parents dwelling habitually in slums seems to have been overlooked, Penrose said. He condemned the fatalism of eugenicists, as they declared there was nothing to be done but to blame heredity and advocate methods of extinction. The wrong-headed ideas of eugenicists led them to wrong-headed solutions, such as sterilization. Even if a country did sterilize every feeble-minded citizen, Penrose warned, the next generation would have plenty of new cases from environmental causes. The first consideration in the prevention of mental deficiency is to consider how environmental influences which are held responsible can be modified, Penrose declared. He suspected that many cases of mental deficiency were caused by a mother's syphilis or X-ray tests during pregnancy. At Colchester, Penrose launched a study he hoped would lead to more humane, more effective treatments for intellectual developmental disorders. He set out to classify the disorders and determine some of their causes. Over the course of 7 years, he examined 1,280 subjects and carefully studied their families as well. Drawing on his expertise in mathematics, Penrose developed sophisticated statistical methods to search his data for links among mental deficiency, heredity, and the environment. As soon as Penrose heard of Froehlich's discovery, he wanted to try it out for himself. It was so simple, he later wrote, that it was puzzling no one had discovered it before. Penrose ordered that urine from 500 patients at Colchester be put to Froehlich's test. Out of those samples, 499 did not change color, but a single sample turned green. The emerald urine belonged to a 19-year-old man who had never walked or talked. He spent his days rocking back and forth, his wasted arms and legs bent close to his body. After the test, Penrose paid a visit to the man's family. His parents were hardworking and healthy, although his father was convinced that people were poisoning him. Their other children were all relatively normal, except their 5-year-old son. Like his older brother, the boy could not walk or speak. Penrose tested the urine of the children and found that they were all normal, except the 5-year-old boy. Studying these and other cases, Penrose proposed that a single hereditary factor was responsible for the disorder. While people with two copies of the recessive factor might be rare, he suggested that many more people might have a single copy. When Penrose published his research, he decided not to use the original name for the disease, Imbacillitas fenylpyruvica. He preferred a new name coined by his collaborator, Judah Quastel, phenylketonuria. It was, Penrose boasted, preferable to the original, more cumbersome designation. That name has stuck ever since, although it's often shortened to PKU, which Penrose called an abominable abbreviation. Over the next few years, an American researcher named George Jervis confirmed Penrose's hypothesis and worked out the chemistry of the disease. Normally, an enzyme known as phenylalanine hydroxylase breaks down the body's extra phenylalanine. In people with PKU, the enzyme doesn't work. The body's phenylalanine reaches toxic levels and spreads throughout the body, wreaking havoc. As the biology of PKU became clearer, Penrose realized that it might not be inevitable, even if it was hereditary. Penrose reasoned that a diet low in phenylalanine might prevent people with PKU from becoming poisoned. But because phenylalanine is so abundant in food, Penrose found it difficult to draw up a diet for his patients. He restricted the diet of one patient to only fruit, sugar, and olive oil, supplemented with vitamin pills. It lowered his patient's phenylalanine levels for a couple of weeks, but they bounced back up. Seeking help, Penrose contacted Frederick Gowland Hopkins, a Cambridge biochemist who had won the Nobel Prize in 1929 for the discovery of vitamins. When Penrose told Hopkins about PKU, Hopkins declared that a diet for the disorder would cost £1,000 a week. Penrose abandoned a search for a diet, but he continued to study people with PKU. Whenever he visited a new institution, he would sniff the air for a musty odor. If he discovered patients who he suspected of having PKU, he would examine them for other telltale features of the condition, such as fair hair and blue eyes. Then he would order a simple urine test. In 1939, while on a trip through the United States, Penrose paid a visit to the Vineland Training School. There he met the 19-year-old Carol Buck. "I was informed that this patient was the daughter of a distinguished writer, but that, in spite of obtaining all the best opinions in the United States, no cause for the defect had been found," Penrose later wrote. Penrose met Carol at the cottage her mother, Pearl, had built for her. "Everything was beautifully appointed," he recalled. But when Penrose sniffed the air, he detected the familiar mustiness. He noticed Carol's blue eyes and fair hair. He checked her reflexes. "I felt quite certain of the diagnosis and told my hosts what I thought," Penrose said. Penrose was dismayed that his hosts didn't know what he was talking about. It had been 5 years since Ferling had published the first account of PKU. Even at an advanced institution like Vineland, however, no one recognized it as a possible cause of retardation. "Impossible," they said. "How can you come here and in a few minutes find something which all our best clinicians have missed?" Penrose wrote. The next morning, Penrose tested Carol's urine. He saw the wonderful green color. But no one at the school ever told Carol's mother about Penrose's diagnosis. Penrose, a lifelong pacifist, sat out World War II in Canada. In 1945, he got an invitation back home to become the next Galton Professor of Eugenics at University College London and director of the Galton Laboratory. The irony of the titles was not lost on him. Francis Galton, the scientist who had coined the term eugenics, had left some of his family fortune to pay for a professor to run a eugenics research lab, gathering data about heredity in the hopes of improving the human race. After Galton's death in 1911, the lab buzzed with research for 3 decades, until it fell to German bombs. Penrose agreed to rebuild it, but it would not be the same when he was done. He sought to wipe eugenics away. He even changed the name of his position to Galton Professor of Human Genetics, but only after a legal battle that lasted until 1963. As the new Galton professor, Penrose was required to give an inaugural lecture. He used the opportunity to let the world know that things had changed, and he used PKU as a case study. The title of his talk was "Phenylketonuria, A Problem in Eugenics." As Penrose drafted his lecture in 1945, the memories of the Holocaust were still horrifically fresh. It had been less than a year since Auschwitz, Dachau, and Bergen-Belsen had been liberated. The Nazis had justified the horrors of their race hygiene by pointing to the work of eugenicists. In the post-war years, Penrose now worried that eugenics might survive their defeat. Leading eugenicists in England and other countries were still pushing their agenda. In the United States, sterilization laws justified on the basis of eugenics remained on the books, and people were being regularly robbed of the chance to have children. In his lecture, Penrose directed his wrath at lingering eugenicists, showing how their calls to manage human reproduction for the betterment of the species were absurd, pernicious ideas based upon emotional bias, as he put it. And Penrose used PKU as a case study for why the eugenics agenda should be thrown out. By 1946, scientists had studied some 500 people with PKU, and their family histories clearly demonstrated that the disease was hereditary. In other words, children had to inherit the same version of a gene from both parents. Scientists still didn't know what genes were, but to a eugenicist, Penrose speculated, that wouldn't matter. To get rid of PKU, all that would be required would be to stop people from passing the gene down to future generations. This view, however, is incorrect, Penrose said. We cannot take the same attitude here that we might with regard to some noxious pest and simply ask to have the offending genes exterminated. PKU was a recessive condition, meaning that a child had to inherit two faulty copies of the same gene to develop the diseases. As far as Penrose and other scientists could tell, people with a single copy of the defective gene were healthy. So healthy, in fact, that it was impossible to identify carriers until they had children with PKU. Based on the number of cases he had found, Penrose estimated that 1% of people in Great Britain were carriers. Later research would indicate that the true figure is probably twice that. To eliminate the gene from the racial stock would involve sterilizing 1% of the normal population, if carriers could be identified, Penrose declared. Only a lunatic would advocate such a procedure to prevent the occurrence of a handful of harmless imbeciles. When Penrose treated people with PKU, their relatives would anxiously ask him how likely it was that they might be carriers. Should they not have children? Penrose worked through the odds. The chances of a sibling of someone with PKU being a carrier is 2 in 3. Penrose estimated that the chances of a prospective mate also being a carrier was 1 in 100. And the chance of a child of 2 carriers inheriting PKU was 1 in 4. Multiplying all those probabilities together led Penrose to conclude that the chance of a relative of someone with PKU having a child with PKU was only 1 in 600. In my opinion, Penrose said, this risk is no adequate ground for discouraging the union. In a sly aside, Penrose also noted that PKU undermined the Nazi myth of an Aryan race that was superior to races of Jews or blacks. In the United States, Jervis had not found any Jews or blacks with PKU. Instead, many of the people with the disease were Germans and Dutch. A sterilization program to control phenylketonuria confined to the so-called Aryans would hardly have appealed to the recently overthrown government of Germany, Penrose said. To finish up his lecture, Penrose predicted that the story of PKU would turn out to be similar for many other diseases. Many rare recessive disabilities have been identified in man, and doubtless many more lie awaiting detection, he said. Not improbably, about 2 people out of every 3 are carriers of at least 1 serious recessive defect. Humanity, in other words, was not some genetically uniform stock that could be purged of a few defectives. Penrose saw our species as rich with genetic diversity and forever falling short of genetic perfection. To eliminate imperfection would demand eliminating humanity itself. After his attack on eugenics, Penrose went on to build the first large medical genetics program designed to identify new hereditary disorders. The geneticists under Penrose's leadership in the early 1950s examined patients, ran blood tests, and drew pedigrees. They traced the inheritance of genes, despite still not knowing what genes are. But if they had taken a stroll down Bloomsbury Street to King's College London, they could have watched a woman take X-ray pictures that would soon start to unravel that mystery. By the 1920s, Thomas Hunt Morgan and his colleagues had persuaded their fellow scientists that genes were physical things, located in chromosomes. Chromosomes were chemical mixtures, including proteins, as well as a mysterious molecule called deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA for short. By the early 1950s, researchers had performed some elegant experiments with bacteria and viruses that made it clear that DNA, not proteins, was the stuff of genes. When viruses infected bacteria, for example, they only injected DNA. None of their proteins made it into the cells. In 1950, a 30-year-old scientist named Rosalind Franklin arrived at King's College London to study the shape of DNA. She and a graduate student named Raymond Gosling created crystals of DNA, which they bombarded with X-rays. The beams bounced off the crystals and struck photographic film, creating telltale lines, spots, and curves. Other scientists had tried to take pictures of DNA, but no one had created pictures as good as Franklin had. Looking at the pictures, she suspected that DNA was a spiral-shaped molecule, a helix. But Franklin was relentlessly methodical, refusing to indulge in flights of fancy before the hard work of collecting data was done. She kept taking pictures. Two other scientists, Francis Crick and James Watson, did not want to wait. Up in Cambridge, they were toying with metal rods and clamps, searching for plausible arrangements of DNA. Based on hasty notes Watson had written during a talk by Franklin, he and Crick put together a new model. Franklin and her colleagues from King's paid a visit to Cambridge to inspect it, and she bluntly told Crick and Watson they had gotten the chemistry all wrong. Franklin went on working on her X-ray photographs and growing increasingly unhappy with King's. The assistant lab chief, Morris Wilkins, was under the impression that Franklin was hired to work directly for him. She would have none of it, bruising Wilkins's ego and leaving him to grumble to Crick about our dark lady. Eventually, a truce was struck, with Wilkins and Franklin working separately on DNA. But Wilkins was still Franklin's boss, which meant that he got copies of her photographs. In January 1953, he showed one particularly telling image to Watson. Now Watson could immediately see in those images how DNA was shaped. He and Crick also got hold of a summary of Franklin's unpublished research she wrote up for the Medical Research Council, which guided them further to their solution. Neither bothered to consult Franklin about using her hard-earned pictures. The Cambridge and King's teams then negotiated a plan to publish a set of papers in Nature on April 25, 1953. Crick and Watson unveiled their model in a paper that grabbed most of the attention. Franklin and Gosling published their X-ray data in another paper, which seemed to readers to be a Me Too effort. Franklin died of cancer 5 years later, while Crick, Watson, and Wilkins went on to share the Nobel Prize in 1962. In his 1968 book, The Double Helix, Watson would cruelly caricature Franklin as a belligerent, badly dressed woman who couldn't appreciate what was in her pictures. That bitter fallout is a shame, because these scientists had together discovered something of exceptional beauty. They had found a molecular structure that could make heredity possible. DNA, they discovered, is a pair of strands twisted into a double helix. Between the strands, a series of compounds called bases bonded to each other. Over the next 30 years, scientists worked out how this structure allowed DNA to carry genes. Each gene is a stretch of DNA, made up of thousands of bases. Each base can take one of four different forms: adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, ACGT for short. A cell carries out a series of chemical reactions to translate a gene's sequence of bases into a protein. A cell first makes a copy of the gene, creating a single-stranded series of bases called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. That RNA molecule is taken up by a molecular factory called a ribosome, which reads the sequence of RNA and builds a corresponding protein. The discovery of DNA seemed to reduce heredity to a reliably simple recipe. It came down to turning one DNA molecule into a pair. A cell's molecular machinery pulled apart the two strands of a DNA molecule and then assembled a new strand to accompany each of them. Each base could bond only to one other, A to T, C to G. The cell could thus build two perfect copies of the original DNA, like engendering like, but on an atomic scale. Sometimes cells make mistakes, however. These errors leave one of the new DNA molecules altered. A single base may change from A to C. A stretch of 100 bases may be accidentally copied out twice. 1,000 bases may be cut out altogether. These are the mutations that scientists like Hugo de Vries and Thomas Hunt Morgan spent years trying to figure out. Mutations can produce new versions of genes, alleles, as they came to be known. Sometimes alleles work the same as before, but in cases such as PKU, they fail to work at all. Later generations of scientists would use this discovery to determine the molecular details of PKU. The enzyme Jervis had discovered, phenylalanine hydroxylase, is encoded by a gene called PAH. In our livers, cells translate the PAH gene into the enzyme, which can then break down phenylalanine. In carriers, such as Pearl and Lossing Buck, one copy of the PAH gene carries a mutation that prevents cells from making the enzyme. Pearl and Lossing had no idea that anything was wrong in their DNA, because their other copy of the PAH gene lacked the mutation. They could make enough phenylalanine hydroxylase for their metabolism to run properly. But when a child like Carol inherited a faulty copy of the PAH gene from both her parents, she could not make any working enzymes and suffered the consequences. 50 years would pass after Ferling and Penrose proposed that PKU was caused by recessive factors before scientists finally saw the factors with their own eyes. By then, however, the lives of people with PKU had already dramatically improved. A child born with PKU, if properly cared for, would never have to face a future like that of Carol Buck. The journey to a treatment started in 1949 when a British woman named Mary Jones brought her 17-month-old daughter Sheila to a Birmingham hospital. Sheila couldn't stand or even sit up, nor did she take an interest in her surroundings. A doctor at the hospital named Horst Bickle examined Sheila and informed Jones that she had PKU. Her mother was not at all impressed when I showed her proudly my beautiful paper chromatogram with a very strong phenylalanine, PHE, spot in the urine of her daughter, proving the diagnosis, Bickle later recalled. Jones wanted to know what Bickle was going to do now that he had discovered Sheila's disease. There was nothing to do, Bickle explained. Jones rejected his answer. She came back the next morning to demand help. When he turned her down, she came back every morning with the same demand. She was very upset and did not accept the fact that at the time no treatment was known for PKU, Bickle said. Couldn't I find one? At the time, Bickle had little reason to think he could. Lionel Penrose had already tried to design a diet for PKU, without any results to show for it. Penrose became convinced that mental retardation wasn't caused by the inability to convert phenylalanine. Instead, he thought, the two symptoms both arose from an unknown source. A diet was no more likely to cure PKU retardation than eyeglasses would make an old man's wrinkles disappear. Jones was so insistent, though, that Bickle decided to talk to some of his colleagues about a diet for PKU. He learned that a biochemist in London named Louis Wolfe had tried concocting a broth that could provide protein to people with PKU without poisoning them with phenylalanine. When he proposed feeding his broth to patients, his superiors at Great Ormond Street Hospital told him his job did not involve crazy treatments for the incurable. Wolfe gave his recipe to Bickle, who followed the directions, working in a frigid lab kept cold to prevent the concoction from spoiling. Eventually, Bickle prepared enough of the stuff for Sheila. He instructed Jones that the girl was to eat nothing else. To his delight, the phenylalanine in Sheila's bloodstream dropped and did not bounce back the way it had in Penrose's experiments 15 years earlier. The diet even showed signs of improving her brain. Within a few months, she began to sit up, then to stand, then to walk with assistance. Her musty odor even disappeared. But when Bickle told his colleagues at the hospital, they scoffed. They were sure Sheila had improved merely thanks to the extra attention she was getting. Bickle decided there was only one way to persuade them. Take Sheila off of the diet. Without telling Jones, Bickle secretly added phenylalanine to the formula. Within a day on the altered diet, Sheila started deteriorating. Soon she stopped smiling, making eye contact, or even walking. Bickle and his co-workers told Jones of their secret maneuver and put her back on the low phenylalanine formula. While the transformation was enough proof for Bickle, he didn't think it would be enough to persuade skeptical colleagues. He got Jones's permission to bring Sheila into the hospital and feed her phenylalanine again. This time, Bickle captured her decline by filming a silent movie. In the first scene in the movie, Sheila is on Bickle's phenylalanine-free diet. She looks healthy and alert. She sits in a high chair, and behind her is draped a curtain covered in fleur-de-lis. An arm, swathed in a lab coat sleeve, moves into the frame, dangling a ring of keys. Sheila looks up at the keys. She studies them, and then reaches upward. As she taps the keys, she watches them swing back and forth. Sheila then grasps one of the keys in her own fingers. Now another lab coat arm moves into the frame, bringing forward a rattle. She makes the difficult choice between keys and rattle calmly. She takes the keys and flings them to the floor. The next scene was shot after Sheila went back on an ordinary diet for 3 days. She is a profoundly different child. She sits on the floor, gazing into middle space, her hair a chaotic tuft. When someone shows her keys, she takes several seconds to notice them. She reaches slowly, drooling, but can't grasp them. The movie jumps ahead 2 days. Now Sheila doesn't even bother to reach for the keys. She just looks at them and cries. The screen turns black again. 4 weeks after resuming her low phenylalanine diet, a card reads. In the next scene, Sheila is walking, pushing a chair across the room with stubborn determination. She looks up with an intense gaze, not sad, not happy, perhaps just wondering what she's been put through. Bickle's movie was impressive enough to change the minds of doctors at Great Ormond Street. Wolf, Bickle, and their colleagues got the green light to put more children on the low phenylalanine diet. In every case, they saw significant improvements. The diet wasn't a panacea by any means. While the children scored better on intelligence tests, they remained far below average because they had already suffered so much irreversible brain damage. The researchers also saw that the benefits could vanish if parents didn't sustain the diet every day. Sheila Jones kept getting better, learning to scribble with a crayon and build a tower of bricks. But her mother, a single parent struggling with mental illness, couldn't keep up Sheila's demanding diet. Eventually, Mary Jones ended up in an institution, and Sheila had to be put in one as well. Without the diet Bickle and Wolf had invented, Sheila Jones was doomed to live there the rest of her life. She learned to feed and dress herself, but she never learned to speak. Bickle and Wolf's breakthrough inspired other scientists and pharmaceutical companies to concoct better formulas. As scientists studied how children on these diets turned out, they found that the earlier they got away from phenylalanine, the better off they were in the long run. In the 1950s, however, doctors were still using Fehrling's test to detect PKU, which works only after children have built up relatively high levels of phenylpyruvic acid in their urine. To make the diets more effective, they'd need an earlier test. At the time, scientists knew that PKU was caused by a recessive gene, and they also knew that the gene must be a specific sequence of DNA on a chromosome, but no one knew where it was. Even if they had known, they wouldn't have been able to sequence it, because the technology required would not become available for many decades. Instead, researchers tried to invent new tests for PKU that could detect lower levels of phenylalanine. In 1957, a California pediatrician named Willard Centerwall figured out how to diagnose PKU by dabbing a child's diaper with ferric chloride. His test made it possible for doctors to identify children with the disease when they were still just a few weeks old. Soon afterward, an American medical researcher named Robert Guthrie developed a test that used blood rather than urine. Guthrie's test was quick, reliable, and cheap. Even better, it could detect PKU in a newborn with just a pinprick's worth of blood. These advances were celebrated in the Saturday Evening Post, Time, and the New York Times. Before 1960, only 25% of people with PKU lived to the age of 30, the majority dying young of infections in institutions. But now doctors could detect it and then treat it. Although PKU affected only a few hundred Americans, the press hailed the work of Guthrie and others as an unprecedented victory over heredity. At the same time, thanks in part to Pearl Buck's Child Who Never Grew, many parents of retarded children had cast off their shame and were organizing. While there were many causes of retardation, the parents put the spotlight on PKU to inspire more support for care and research. As part of the 1961 National Retarded Children's Week, President John F. Kennedy welcomed two sisters with PKU, Cammy and Sheila McGrath, to the White House. Both girls had PKU, but it had affected their lives in fundamentally different ways. Sheila, the older sister, had been diagnosed with PKU when she was a year old. By then, she had suffered so much brain damage that at age 7, she was now living in an institution. When the McGraths had Cammie 2 years later, their doctor used Centerwall's diaper test to diagnose her with PKU at 3 weeks. The McGraths immediately put her on a diet of special protein powder and low-protein foods. She had avoided Sheila's toxic exposure, and now, at age 5, she was healthy and living at home. When the McGrath family came to the cabinet room of the White House, Kennedy greeted them personally. He led Cammie to a rocking horse and watched her rock on it. "Atta girl," the president said. "They are the best-behaved children we've had in the White House, and that includes those who live here." The McGrath family visit is memorialized by an official White House photograph. Cammie and her parents stand by the president, looking at Sheila. She sits on a rocking horse, gazing away. In May the following year, Sheila and Cammie appeared in Life, posing for a photo essay about Guthrie's test. Cammie, her hair in pigtails, grins over a mountain of protein powder poured onto a table. Sheila, her hair chopped short, is wearing a dark dress and sitting in a rocking chair set back from the table. The wordless image delivered a clear message. Modern medicine had allowed Cammie to avoid Sheila's fate. "The sentencing is not mandatory," the New York Times declared. "Phenylketonuria can be kept in check if diagnosed early enough, and a child can live a normal life." In December 1961, the Kennedy administration panel moved to seek mandatory testing for PKU of all newborns. In 1963, Massachusetts passed a law that required screening for the disease, and other states soon followed. Within 10 years, 90% of American children were being screened, and Guthrie and other researchers set up PKU testing programs in other countries as well. In later years, other hereditary disorders would be added to newborn screening, giving children as much of a head start as possible. By the 1970s, the first generation of people treated for PKU since birth reached adulthood. They could finish school, hold jobs, have ordinary lives. In 2001, a graduate student named Tracy Beck became the first person with PKU to gain a PhD. She became an astronomer, helping to build the James Webb Space Telescope. For thousands of years, people who inherited the mutations in Beck's PAH genes would have looked to the sky and not known the word for the lights they saw. Now Beck was helping to extend humanity's gaze to the farthest edges of the universe. In 1957, the Vineland Training School decided to test all their students for PKU. One of the few to test positive was Carol Buck. In one sense, the result was nothing new. Penrose had made the same diagnosis 20 years before, using Furling's crude test. But this time, the school told Pearl Buck. She could finally give Carol's condition a name, nearly 4 decades after it had altered her own life. The name was new to Buck. She studied up on it, and when she traveled to Norway in 1958, she sought out Furling himself. Buck learned as much as she could from the 70-year-old doctor. Soon afterward, she wrote a letter to her ex-husband, Lossing. She explained to him that they shared an invisible bond, one that neither had known about. After Pearl and Lossing had divorced, he had remarried. He and his second wife had 2 healthy children. In her letter, Pearl warned Lossing that they may have inherited his dangerous legacy. "In Carol's case, nothing matters. It is too late," she wrote. "But I think of your children, who carry the genes in their bodies. It is essential before they marry that this blood is tested, and the blood of the person they marry." In 1960, Willard Centerwall paid Pearl Buck a visit at her home in Pennsylvania. She confided in him that Carol had recently been diagnosed with PKU. From a pocket, Centerwall produced a vial of phenylacetate crystals. He invited Buck to sniff it. Immediately she recalled that Carol, as a child, had the same unusual odor, Centerwall later remembered. Buck did not write anything about Centerwall's visit, about smelling an odor that took her back 40 years to Nanking, to the bamboo garden where she watched her daughter play. We can't know what it was like for Buck to suddenly learn that this odor had actually been a signal. It might have told her about her own genetic makeup, about a rare genetic variant that she had inherited from her mother or her father, a variant that Lossing had also acquired from his own ancestry, which they had combined in their child. We don't know what it was like to discover all this at the very point when children with PKU could at least be treated, to learn that every meal she made for Carol was unwitting poison. What little we do know comes from her other daughter, Janice. In 1992, Janice recalled that Pearl had trouble accepting that her family's genes may have contributed to this disorder. In the 1960s, as the first generation of PKU children got to grow up with healthy brains, life went on for Carol and Pearl much as it had for decades. Every December, Pearl wrote a letter to the Vineland Training School with a list of gifts to be purchased for Carol, who was now in her 40s. Crayons and coloring books, beads, glazed fruit, candy, doll blankets, a musical top. The list didn't change from one Christmas to the next. In 1972, Pearl paid her last visit to Carol. She had been diagnosed with lung cancer, and her treatments would keep her alive only a few months after the diagnosis. Carol Buck outlived her mother by another 20 years. She, too, was diagnosed with lung cancer. She died at age 72 in 1992 and was buried on the grounds of the Vineland Training School, across the street from Emma Wolverton's grave. Neither Carol nor her mother smoked, raising the possibility that they shared a different mutation that raised their risk of the disease. PKU is rare, but its story has been told many more times than far more common disorders. It has a powerful moral, but the moral depends on who tells the story. For some, the story of PKU embodies the triumph of genetics. Mendel's early followers had been mocked by those who couldn't believe that experiments on peas could account for why like engenders like. Mendel's work opened the way to the discovery of genes, and now scientists were finding precise effects of genes on health. Genetics not only explained how PKU arose, but allowed doctors to tame it. In the mid-1980s, a gigantic project took shape that would allow future generations of researchers to quickly find the mutations behind any hereditary disease. Rather than examine the DNA of a single gene, they wanted to sequence every bit of DNA in all 46 human chromosomes, the entire human genome. The possession of a genetic map and the DNA sequence of a human being will transform medicine, promised the Nobel Prize-winning biologist Walter Gilbert. To show how this transformation would happen, Francis Collins, the director of the National Center for Human Genome Research at the time, offered the PKU story. Scientists found the inherited flaw and then devised a rational treatment for it. If you simply remove foods with phenylalanine from the child's diet, he or she will live a normal and healthy life, Collins declared. Sequencing the entire human genome would make it possible for scientists to pinpoint mutations that caused thousands of other diseases and potentially open the way to treatments for them as well. PKU is the example where the paradigm was proven, Collins said. To other scientists, however, PKU demonstrated the deep flaws in such gene-centered research. From the earliest days of genetics, researchers recognized that it was a fallacy to talk about a gene being for a trait or a disease. Genes don't have so much power. They exist in an environment, and their effects may be very different in different surroundings. Thomas Hunt Morgan, for example, had observed how a mutation in his flies made them sprout extra legs, but only in cold temperatures. Once researchers discovered a diet for PKU, it became an even better illustration of the malleability of genes. In 1972, the British biologist Stephen Rose declared that PKU demonstrated how pointless it was to talk about something like a high IQ gene. A variant of the PAH gene could lead to low intelligence test scores if a child was left untreated, or the same child could score in the normal range if given the right diet. Hence, the environment has triumphed over the genetic deficiency of the individual, Rose said. To talk of high IQ genes, or to try to disentangle the genetic program from the environment in which it is expressed, is both disingenuous and misleading. No matter which moral people drew from PKU, their stories had one thing in common. Science had triumphed utterly over the disease. In 1995, the journalist Robert Wright told his own PKU story as a way to attack the idea that our intelligence is fixed by the genes we inherit. In the absence of any treatment, Wright observed, PKU mutations will reliably cause children to have devastating intellectual disabilities. It turns out, he cheerfully wrote, that if you put all infants on a diet low in the amino acid phenylalanine, the disease disappears. It should come as no surprise that neither Wright, Rose, nor Collins themselves had PKU, or ever had to care for a child with it. Even with the most sophisticated diets and supplements medicine can offer, PKU never disappears. Starting in the 1950s, children with PKU began to escape the devastation of brain damage, but only if they stuck relentlessly to the dreary regimen of foul-tasting concoctions. Over the years, the PKU foods became tastier, but children growing up on a low phenylalanine diet still had to watch their friends gorge themselves on pizza and ice cream, sometimes ending up feeling isolated from society. When the first generation of children with PKU grew up, doctors allowed them as adults to switch to a regular diet. They soon suffered a new round of symptoms as the phenylalanine surged back into their bodies. Now people with PKU are urged to stay on the diet for their entire lives. It's often a struggle to get the right balance of nutrients each day while avoiding even the slightest trace of phenylalanine. For now, the experience of the disease is a tense negotiation between heredity and the world in which it unfolds. Part 2. Wayward DNA. Chapter 5. An Evening's Revelry. In 1901, William Bateson sent an urgent report to the Royal Society on the facts of heredity. Those facts, Bateson explained, had just been thrown into sharp relief with the rediscovered, newly appreciated work of Gregor Mendel. Bateson and other scientists were confirming the patterns that Mendel had observed. Those patterns were so trustworthy and so profound, Bateson said, that they deserved one of the loftiest titles in science, Mendel's Law. A scientific law predicts some aspect of the universe, usually with a short, sweet equation. Isaac Newton discovered the laws of motion that came to bear his name. Robert Boyle is memorialized with Boyle's Law, which predicts the pressure of a gas from its volume. Mendel's work likewise gave heredity a numerical clarity. Parents have a 50-50 chance of passing down either of their two copies of a given gene. Mendel's law ensures a 3-to-1 ratio between dominant and recessive traits. It doesn't matter if the trait is a wrinkled coat on a pea or PKU in humans. The numbers stay the same. Mendel's discovery was indeed one of the most important in the history of science, but the patterns he saw aren't really a law. Newton's laws of motion are as true in a distant galaxy as they are here on Earth. They were as true 13 billion years ago in the universe's infancy as they are true today. Mendel's law has far narrower boundaries. It is only relevant to places where life exists. In other words, as far as we know, only on Earth. Even when life first emerged some 4 billion years ago as single-celled microbes, Mendel's law did not yet exist. Microbes are not like pea plants or people, and as a result, they don't have dominant or recessive characters. Mendel's law would have to wait for a couple billion years or so for a new lineage of life to emerge, one that would give rise to plants, fungi, and animals like us. Mendel's law, in other words, is less like Boyle's law than it is like our spleens or our retinas. It emerged as life evolved. Earth is actually home to many different kinds of heredity, each arising through a combination of natural selection and lucky flukes. Life likely emerged as its early simple chemistry got complicated. Amino acids, bases, and other molecular building blocks were present on the early Earth. Short chains of these compounds may have concentrated together, perhaps trapped in oily films on the seafloor or encased in cell-like bubbles. Crowded into these cramped spaces, their chemistry may have accelerated, pushing them over the border dividing non-life from life. It's likely that the first life forms were profoundly unlike life today. Today, animals, plants, and bacteria, all cellular life in fact, encode their genetic information in DNA. But DNA would be an unlikely candidate for the first hereditary molecule, because it's both helpless and demanding. In order for a cell to read the information stored in its DNA, it needs to deploy many proteins and RNA molecules at once. When a cell divides, it needs another army of molecules to make a second copy of its DNA. The first life on Earth must have had a simpler beginning. One possibility is that life started out without DNA or proteins. Instead, it relied solely on RNA molecules. A primordial cell might have contained a few different types of short RNA molecules that helped each other replicate. Experiments with RNA molecules suggest how this would have unfolded. One RNA molecule might grab bases and weld them together, using a second RNA molecule as a template. That second molecule might do the same for a third. If the last RNA gene in the line turned around and helped the first one, the entire circle could feed back on itself. These primordial RNA molecules would have had a twofold form of heredity. They inherited the genetic information from their ancestor, and also the same twisted shape that allowed them to help build new molecules. This first heredity would have also been sloppy. Sometimes a new RNA molecule would turn out to be slightly different from its template. This error would often be fatal, making it impossible for the RNA molecules to copy themselves any further. But in a few cases, it would actually improve the chemistry. Faster replicating cells would have outcompeted their slower rivals. RNA-based life, living in an ocean or a tide pool, may well have lived amidst loose amino acids. As their RNA molecules evolved into more sophisticated forms, some of them may have begun connecting amino acids into short chains called peptides. These peptides may have been able to do jobs of their own inside of cells, and with time, the peptides may have grown into large, complex proteins. It's also possible that some RNA-based life evolved to make DNA as well. The double-stranded DNA molecules would have proven more stable than single-stranded RNA, and also less prone to damage. When the early DNA-based organisms copied their genes, they made fewer mistakes. Their newfound accuracy could have opened the way for more complexity in life, since they had a lower risk of ending up with a life-stopping mutation. Once DNA-based life took hold, it overran the planet. By about 3.5 billion years ago, these single-celled microbes had diverged into two great evolutionary branches, known as bacteria and archaea. They're impossible to tell apart under a microscope, but they have some important differences in their biochemistry. Bacteria and archaea use different molecules to build their cell walls, for example, and use different molecules to read their genes. But both lineages of microbes proved astonishingly versatile, adapting to just about every bit of Earth where they could get water and energy. Microbes adapted to grow on the sea surface, catching sunlight, on the sea floor, where they ate sulfur and iron, deep in the Earth, where they harnessed the energy of radioactivity. Scientists estimate that Earth is home to about 1 million billion billion microbes, which may belong to a trillion different species. But none of them follow Mendel's law. A typical microbe, say the Escherichia coli dwelling in your gut, has only a single chromosome, a long circle of DNA. Arrayed along that loop are several thousand genes. If E. coli can draw in some glucose or another sugar from your breakfast, it can grow until it's ready to replicate. It elegantly unwinds the two strands of the circle. Onto each strand, the cell builds a second one, creating two nearly identical chromosomes. The cell then cuts itself in two. It drags its two chromosomes to opposite sides and then builds a wall down its middle. Each of the new microbes is a near-perfect copy of its ancestor, inheriting a chromosome as well as about half of the molecules in the ancestor's cell. We humans can have the opportunity to get to know our parents. For microbes, that chance never comes, because their ancestors vanish, or, to put it another way, split into their daughter cells. Mendel's law describes how hereditary factors from two parents combine to produce an organism. To a microbe, it's meaningless. The heredity of microbes is different from ours in another important way. They can inherit genes along many different routes. They can gain genes as we do, as copies of the genes of their direct ancestors. This process is known as vertical inheritance. But they can also inherit genes from unrelated microbes through horizontal inheritance. Horizontal inheritance helped scientists discover what genes were made of. In the 1920s, researchers discovered that if they killed deadly strains of bacteria and mixed them with harmless ones, the harmless strains turned deadly. What's more, when the transformed bacteria divided, their descendants inherited their deadliness. Later, a microbiologist named Oswald Avery and his colleagues isolated the different kinds of molecules inside bacteria to figure out which was the mysterious transforming principle. Through many rounds of experiments, they came down in favor of DNA. It turned out that the bacteria Avery studied were being transformed by taking up loose DNA and incorporating some of it into their own chromosome. They gained genes that they could use to make their hosts sick. But later research has revealed that horizontal inheritance can also take place by other means. Along with their main chromosomes, for example, microbes often carry ringlets of DNA, called plasmids, with genes of their own. Microbes will sometimes build tubes that they stick into other microbes, pumping